I want to begin by sort of mentioning what are often perceived as very basic dichotomies in thinking about biblical texts. Home versus exile, power versus powerlessness, hope versus despair and resignation. And I mention these because I wanted to kick us off tonight by looking at a text from the prophet Jeremiah that I think, among other things, collapses or complicates, if you want to be pretentious, problematizes these dichotomies, and offers us a picture, I think, of inviting the people in the wake of the destruction, we're going to talk about that in just a second, to live with the complexity of the moment in which they find themselves. It is customary when people talk about the destruction of the first temple to talk about how everything was destroyed and obliterated. That is, you might call, the Tisha B'Av narrative, right? That's the story that we tell. You have a combination of political defeat as well as theological devastation. One of the interesting things about the destruction of the first temple is that it is precisely through defeat that the Israelites end up developing an idea of divine omnipotence. Okay? That is because the narrative, the obvious narrative is, we were defeated. That means, like everywhere else in the ancient Near East, our God lost to their God. But the exiles decide on a different claim. Our God wasn't defeated by their God. Our God is using those people to play out that God's drama, my God's drama, with you. So out of the jaws of defeat comes this more robust notion of omnipotence, because our defeat is not a sign of God's loss. It's a sign of God's total governance over history. But that is a reaction to the possibility of despair, right? The possibility of despair is our God has been defeated, or just as bad, our God is indifferent to us. Our God no longer cares about us. Our God has abandoned us. Perhaps the most dramatic expression, and we'll see this text briefly later, the most dramatic expression of despair after the destruction of the temple is Psalm 139, Al-Naharot Bavel, familiar to many of you, by the waters of Babylon, which, interestingly, begins with some of the most memorable verses in the Hebrew Bible, right? Imeshkachech Yerushalayim, etc., if I forget you or Jerusalem, and ends with two of the most jarring and upsetting verses in the Hebrew Bible. You know, fortunate is the one who destroys your baby's heads upon a rock, right? Horrific imagery capturing the despair and rage of the exiles. What I want to try to do is look at a very different mode that at least one prophet enters into in thinking about coping with the devastation of exile. And that's the prophet Jeremiah, about whom I only want to say one thing. It is sort of customary in like popular presentations of Jeremiah to describe him as a prophet of doom. And that is exactly 50% true. Meaning, he is a prophet of doom. He is insistent in the face of incredible personal suffering and persecution that the people's behavior has led to an imminent destruction. And yet, as soon as that destruction comes, Jeremiah immediately becomes a prophet of comfort and consolation who promises that the final word has not been spoken. And there's something very human about this, right? I think if you think about moments of your life, and I know that this can conjure up really painful stuff, so I want to sort of just sort of acknowledge that for a minute. Moments of your life where just an enormous trauma lands on you. And there is a way in which trauma makes a claim to finality. Nothing will ever be the same again. And Jeremiah, in a funny way, is basically saying, yes, that's true, but that doesn't mean the story's over. Nothing ever will be the same again, but the story's also not over. There is life after devastation. Very, very important and fundamental to him. And this will bring us to a bit of a discussion of a theme that you'll see in various ways over the next week, this notion of a home community, a diaspora community, two communities, the relationship between them. And so Jeremiah here is going to do something that is really fundamental and basic about the refusal of the trauma having the last word. We're going to read chapter 29 of the book of Jeremiah. The core of this chapter is a lengthy letter that Jeremiah sends to the exiles who were deported to Babylonia in 597 BCE. That is not the date that most people have in mind as the date of the exile, which is 587 BCE. But 597 is when the first people leave or are sent away. And actually, we are not going to go here. Academic scholars are divided about whether there is one letter that is sent here, two letters that are sent here, or three letters that is sent here. That is sort of classic biblical studies. That's not our question tonight. We're going to look at this letter, which is, just to sort of underscore this point for a second, from after 597, but before 587. That is, when some of the community has already been exiled, but the total exile and destruction of Jerusalem has not yet taken place. And Jeremiah does here something that Jeremiah does throughout his writing or his preaching, which is to convince the community that it has no choice but to embrace Babylonian exile as a long-term reality that has been ordained for it by God. Do not resist going into exile, because it is what God wants from you. And in fact, Jeremiah will accuse countless other prophets of false prophecy precisely because either they counsel not accepting it or they promise you'll go home again in 2 weeks. Don't worry about it. It's going to be okay. Right? So Jeremiah is a prophet of hope who also refuses false comfort, which again is psychologically, I think, really interesting and important. Hope cannot be built on delusion. Jeremiah is very insistent on this point. Hope built on delusion is a lie. The way that I would like to define this chapter is that it has two kind of foci in terms of the thematics of what's going on here. One, as I've just said, is the need for the exiles to accept their fate and know that God has brought it upon them, and that God is nevertheless still working for their ultimate good, right? That's a very important caveat, right? God's story with you is not over, even though it has now run headlong into a wall. And two, the danger, a theme that persists in Jeremiah, both in the prophecies of doom and in the prophecies of hope, do not listen to false prophets. Do not listen to people who give you false hope. Of course, the question of who is a true and false prophet is loaded in countless ways. This is like a very unfrum thing to say, but I'm about to say warning, okay? No, it's interesting. One of the things that more sort of politically leftist Bible scholars point out about Jeremiah is, you know, Jeremiah claims to be the courageous one who's telling them to accept exile, but the false prophets, quote unquote, who are encouraging people to rebel against Babylonia in Babylonia, they're actually the ones risking their life. The people who are saying, yeah, don't accept this, that you don't have to, God's going to on your side, they're actually in tremendous danger on a day-to-day basis. I mean, Jeremiah is also in danger. Look, I'm not sure how much you endanger yourself is the definition of being a prophet, right? If you never endanger yourself, you're not a prophet. If you always endanger yourself, you might just be a lunatic, right? Right, I always like to tell this to young adults, right, that if you're a prophet, people are going to hate you. If people hate you, that doesn't mean you're a prophet. It might mean you're insufferable, right? So, okay, you can predict how well that goes over. To say this one more way, in a way that's even kind of simplistic, but I think helpful, is that the people have to do two things. Number one is embrace the reality of exile, and number two is maintain a long-term hope for return. You cannot bypass number one in order to make number two come true fast. always the temptation, right? Suffering in the Hebrew Bible is the matrix in which hope of God's redemption takes root and takes hold of people. It's precisely in the midst of the crushing suffering of exile that the hope of restoration reemerges.
Why do you need to suffer in order to, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger? Why is that suffering?
So let me answer this in two ways, one in a Jeremiah way, one in a more general way. So for Jeremiah, it's not, and I recognize many people in this room have many different theologies and many different relationships to different parts of Tanakh. Let's just sort of stipulate that for a minute. For Jeremiah, it's not that God is just choosing to make you suffer so that God can later bless you. The suffering is a punishment, or even you might say, a consequence of the way you've chosen to live. Now, from a 21st century perspective, that's really hard, right? Now, bracketing Jeremiah for a minute, I would say that one thing that goes on in the Hebrew Bible in general that I cannot explain, but that I think does tap into a deep truth about the universe, is that in the Hebrew Bible, blessing comes on the heels, and I think you can even say only on the heels, not quite sure about that, of real suffering. That is the story of the Israelites. And by the way, it is also the story of Hagar, which is why she is a figuration of the Israelites. Many of you have heard me talk about that over the years, right? Hagar needs to go back in order to receive the blessings. Now, from a certain perspective, that's like infuriating. But it also captures a deep truth about how many of us experience the world. Many of the deepest blessings of our lives come after enormous struggle and suffering. So I think without explaining it, the Bible may be tapping into something that is a truth. The difference between the Israelites in Egypt and the Judeans in Jeremiah is the Israelites in Egypt, on the surface at least, didn't do anything to deserve their enslavement, whereas Jeremiah is telling a different story. Chapter 27 of Jeremiah, he tells the survivors in Judea that they must accept Babylonian domination of Judah. Chapter 29, which we're about to read, he tells the deportees that they must accept a fundamental position of servitude in Babylonia. The exile is totally formative and fundamental for biblical theology, and yet only a very few texts directly describe the experience of deportation and exile. It's almost as if it is too painful to talk about. Again, refer back to really difficult traumas in our own lives. In a way, it's almost easier to talk about the before and the after, but not the thing itself. Jeremiah 29 is not exactly talking about the experience of being exiled and deported, but it is interesting and exceptional in that it is willing to offer strategies for constructing a sense of home in the midst of having lost one's homeland. And thus is a resonant text in many ways later in Jewish history. How do you construct home in the midst of having lost homeland? We might be tempted to say the opposite of home is homelessness. I think Jeremiah wants to complicate that a little bit, to say you can be in exile and still to some degree be at home. And the danger of that is that when exile ends, you won't want to leave, which is what happens in ancient Judea and which any good Zionist thinker will tell you is the story of the Jews in the late 20th century. I'm not making some political or ideological statement. It's the reality, right? If you teach people to make peace with their life in exile, they will make peace with their life in exile. And then they won't want to go to start again in a society that is starting from scratch. I always like to read early Zionist diaries, which my encapsulation of early Zionist diaries, for those of you who have not read such things, like, diaries of Zionists in 1902 read something like this. I came to redeem the world. I got malaria. Really? I mean, no, really. I mean, that's right. It's hard. It's really hard. It's really, really hard. So there's a reason why people don't go. But I want us to at least think about as we go, what are the downsides of Jeremiah's advice here? What happens when you tell people to make peace at home? What happens when you tell Jews? Everyone, I know this is like the 21st century, so you can't say anything that even sounds like it might be interesting because somebody's going to go nuts, right? But like, what do you do with Jews who have been told, you know, become partners in law firms, become, you know, bankers, become management consultants, and then you're told, okay, time to pack up and go home now. And they're all like, I got a nice apartment on Central Park West. I'm not going anywhere. How many people have I just offended? That was not my intent. I'm just saying, I think it's a reality of what these texts are really struggling with. You read a verse, and then I'll read it in English.
ואלה דברי הספר אשר שלח ירמיה הנביא מירושלים כל יתר זקני הגולה ואל הכהנים ואל הנביאים ואל כל העם אשר הגלה לנבוכדנצר מירושלים בבל.
This is the text of the letter that the prophet Jeremiah sent from Jerusalem to the priests, the prophets, and the rest of the elders of the exile community, and to all of the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon.
אחרי צייק יחוניה המלך והגבירה והסריסים שרי יהודה וירושלים והחרש והמסגר מירושלים.
If you're bored, just hang on until we get to verse 4, which is this is the setup here. After King Yechoniah and the queen mother and the eunuchs. Eunuchs does not mean what you think eunuchs mean. That word evolves in biblical Hebrew from meaning men who have been castrated to servants of the king. The officials of Judah and Jerusalem, the artisans and the smiths had all left Jerusalem.
ביד אל עשה בן שפן וגמריה בן חלקיה אשר שלח צקיה מלך יהודה אל נבוכדנצר מלך בבל בבלה לאמור.
The letter was sent through Elasa, the son of Shaphan, this is a family that was supportive of Jeremiah, and Gemariah, son of Hilkiah, whom King Zedekiah of Judah had dispatched to Babylon to King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. Meaning that there is a group of officials who are being sent to the king, and it's like Jeremiah tucks into the bag a message to the Israelite leaders, the Judean leaders, who are now in Babylonia. While you're there taking a message to the king, could you give this letter to the exiles, please? Okay? And now begins the letter. Have you ever wanted to start a letter like that? Thus says the Lord. I've actually been tempted to send it to my kids at summer camp when I want to make sure they're doing what I say. No, okay, so, right? Thus said the God of hosts, the Lord of Israel, the God of Israel, to the entire community that I have exiled from Jerusalem to Babel. Please notice the community that I have exiled. Not Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is a tool of mine. I, God, have exiled. Meaning this is very important to them in a way that I think might be a little foreign for many of us, which is the insistence that in general, but certainly major events of Jewish history are ultimately orchestrated by the providential hand of God. So Nebuchadnezzar, this goes back to what I said earlier about omnipotence, right? Nebuchadnezzar paradoxically becomes a tool for affirming God's total power, okay? Build houses and sit in them. Plant gardens and eat the fruit those gardens produce.
קחו נשים והולידו בנים ובנות וקחו לבניכם נשים ואת בנותיכם תנו לאנשים ותלדנה בנים ובנות ורבו שם ואל תמעטו.
You should take wives and give birth to sons and daughters and take wives for your sons and give your daughters to men in marriage and let them too have sons and daughters. Be fruitful there. Make sure your population does not decrease.
V'dirshu et shalom ha'ir asher higleiti etchem shama, v'hitpalalu ba'aga, El Adonai ki v'shlama yiyeh lachem shalom.
This is considered one of the great bomb verses of the Hebrew Bible. Like, what? Right? Seek the welfare of the city to which I have exiled you. Pray on its behalf to God, because through its peace, you will have peace. This is very different from fortunate is the one who shatters your child's head upon a rock. Pray for the peace of Babylon. I should say, just about the very beginning of this, the exiled community from 597 was very small. According to Jeremiah 52, it consisted of, not that anyone's counting this exactly, 3,023 Jews. However, they clearly, based on this, included a very significant group of people, elders, priests, prophets, etc. And the focus, three times in verse 7 on peace, is really interesting. And the claim here is that peace will not be found in resistance and rebellion, but rather in submission. It is not, this is really, I want to get to this point because this is really quite shocking. Peace is not going to be found, at least not anytime soon, through returning home to land and family, right? But rather, peace will be found through settling in exile and building homes and farms and expanding families there. Psalm 122 instructs, Sha'alu shlom Yerushalayim yishla'u ohavayich. Pray for the shalom of Jerusalem. Let all who dwell in you find peace. Now you might think, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. That's God's city. Pray for the peace of Babylon, says Jeremiah. Pray for the peace of those who destroyed Jerusalem. That is a total subversion. Pray for those who have brought utter devastation on you, your people, your home, and your faith. Pray for them. By the way, many Christian scholars point to these verses as, you could do it this way you want, we are not going to talk about this now unless David Lowenfeld makes me. Many Christian scholars see this as, quote unquote, I'll say this in English in a second, an Old Testament adumbration of Jesus' insistence on love your enemies. Whether that's really the right way of reading this, we'll talk about a little bit later, but it's not a Meshuggah claim. Asking people to pray for the peace of Babylon is really quite something. If I said to Jews in 1943, pray for the peace of Berlin, right? All right, you might choke. Now, that's not a great parallel because the Jews in Babylon are not being murdered. But I'm just talking about the level of hatred and resentment and what's being challenged. I mean, that really is not a good example. I hope that's clear why. But the point I'm trying to make, I hope, is clear. Eli, please.
From a couple of things that you've said, and please correct me if I'm getting any of the history wrong here. I'm just trying to place where we are. Because in five, you mentioned those who have just come and utterly destroyed Jerusalem, which had not actually happened yet.
Yeah, you're right.
That we're talking about, please correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Jeremiah simultaneously like begging and pleading through his counseling of the leadership in Jerusalem to not fight Babel, right? And so is there a way of understanding this as a kind of, frankly, kind of political guidance of saying like, look, you stay quiet over there, I'm trying to keep everybody quiet over here.
Yeah, so you are right. So let me tell you why I said what I said, and then I will take your correction. This text is complicated in that it is written between 597 and 587, but the book that is received is intended for the exiles after 587. So one of the things that scholars talk about a lot is to what extent am I supposed to hear Jeremiah talking in like 596, and to what extent am I supposed to hear Jeremiah talking in like 552? Right? When we're already living there. So that's what I was sort of kind of eliding because they want to go there, but you are right. Now, your point is actually very astute because one way to read what Jeremiah says is that it is purely practical advice. Listen, you guys want to survive, you better hope that Babylon is under control and not beset by war. Because you know what? As outsiders, you'll end up getting caught in the crossfire and get killed. And other interpreters of the text want to say, nobody's saying something much deeper, which has really become part of the society that you're in. And one of the things I will just tell you right now is, I do not know how to settle this debate. When we get to that verse more carefully, I want to sort of open it up. Is this practical, what you call political advice? Or is this also, or is this also spiritual, ethical advice? That's a very hard question. And in fact, I'll just say now that one of the most difficult parts of answering that question is we're going to have to try and understand what the word dir shu et shlom ha'ir means. Seek the peace of the city. If you were to open modern Bible scholars on Jeremiah, some of them will say dir shu is obviously, it's a word that means prayer. And other Bible scholars will say, sometimes it means prayer. Here it's very obvious that it means participate in the life of the city and make sure that it flourishes. There is actually a fair bit at stake in that translation issue, and I'm not sure we can resolve it. Right? Am I being asked in my own shul with my fellow Jews to pray for the peace of the government? Or am I being told, hey, be active residents. Notice I'm not saying citizens. Be active residents in Babylon. Like, build soup kitchens, right? Struggle for a just society. Which am I being told? Very difficult question. I think ultimately an unanswerable question.
I'm also curious as to the translation of shalom, which I think of as peace, and you've been saying peace, and in the translation here, it's prosperity. It seems to be directed to what you're discussing.
Shalom, I've translated as peace, and yet here is translated as welfare or prosperity. This, by the way, is the frustrating part about JPS. JPS, many of you have heard me say this many times, but it is, I think, a useful thing to know. JPS always goes with idiomatic translation, which means they are perfectly willing to translate the same Hebrew word three different ways in the same verse, if that makes it read better. Right? That, I'm not saying that with judgment. I think there is enormous value in that. If you are interested in the literary cues of a biblical text, JPS is not the translation you want to use. If you want to see the other extreme, you can look at those texts that Everett Fox has translated, which are not actually in English. And Everett Fox would not pretend that they're really in English, meaning they are in an English attempt to capture the nuances of the Hebrew. Robert Alter is an attempt to split the difference. Sometimes it works well, sometimes it really does not work, because it's really insisting on choosing neither. Okay, so that's just useful because in case you were wondering, wait, it's the same Hebrew word. Why is it prosperity and welfare in the same verse? Because that reads better. The answer is that it's a hard question. I have not been asked an easy question yet tonight, I'll just note. Shalom, right? Peace with a connotation of wholeness, right? From Shlemut. I think that what JPS is doing here is translating peace to mean something more societal and general. Like the if I were going to translate this, I might have translated shalom as the flourishing. Prosperity and welfare sound a little economic to me, to my ear, in this 21st century, and I don't think that that's the main meaning here. It's like seek the well-being. It's not just peace in the sense of people not killing each other. It's something wholer than that, more holistic than that.
Is this where we get the concept of Mipnei Darkei Shalom, like working with others in an area outside of the Jewish community for the purpose of maintaining good relations?
I think the answer to that is that it is not, but it's not a crazy hypothesis. Meaning, that phrase seems to me to be playing with the verse Drachea Darchei Noam Bechol Nativotea Shalom, that the Torah's ways are the ways of peace and its paths are, or its ways are pleasantness and its paths are peace. But the idea of making peace and acting peacefully when you are a minority culture makes some sense. Now, the issue, just in case people are not clear what's going on here, there's a rabbinic idea that certain things that you might think Jews only owe other Jews, we also owe non-Jews because of the ways of peace. Already, Talmudically, there is a debate about whether that means we wouldn't really do it, but we have to try not to get killed, or whether it means the ways of the Torah are the ways of peace. Or if you wanted to speak in halachic language, is that a bidiyavad or a lechatchila? Is that a like, oh yeah, fine. You want to feed their poor, because you have no choice. Or is it, of course you feed their poor. I mean, what kind of conversation is this? There's a lot at stake in that. That conversation, by the way, pops up at various points in Jewish history and then pops up with a bit of a vengeance in the early years of the Jewish state, the modern Jewish state, because all of a sudden it has resonance of real power. You know, whether some Jew living in 16th century Prague shares his tzedakah with the Christians, okay, mela, right? Like, what's the, right? But like, whether Jews in a society with, let's say, an army and an economy they control, how they think about their obligations to non-Jews is a very big deal. Jeremiah here is pressing the exiles, you could say, to put down roots, right? To take comfort in the bonds of family, right? And to seek community? Not quite sure that that's right, but I'm going to sort of experimentally, hesitatingly say it. To seek community with the neighborhoods that they live in the settings in Babylon in which they find themselves. These, I want to underscore, would probably not have been welcome instructions. People who have just been kicked out of the place that they consider home, and that they consider not only their home, but on some level God's home, however you take that, whatever you take that to mean exactly, right, do not want to be told, yeah, put down roots here. And also pray for the peace of this community. You can understand why Jeremiah might say, with all due respect, what I was saying was quite courageous. I was asking people to do what nobody wants to do 5 minutes after they leave. Forcibly. Right? The prophet is telling them something like, you do not need to, I mean, here I'm using totally contemporaneous kind of language, you do not need to see yourself permanently as refugees. You can see yourself as residents, not citizens, because as we'll see in a minute, you are going to go home eventually, but residents, right? At the beginning of the book of Jeremiah, God had told Jeremiah, Jeremiah's mission was going to be to uproot and to pull down, to destroy and to overthrow, and then to build and to plant. Leave no tvilin toa, which are verbs that appear here. And that requires some unpacking, right? Is this building and planting somehow a fulfillment of when God said God would do it? You are God's delegates in doing this? Was that promise less about the land of Israel than you might have thought? Was it really a not that great promise? I'm going to make you flourish, just not where you want to flourish. Or, what I would be inclined to say, are the Israelites being, the Judeans, subtly being told, when you build and you plant here in Babylon, that's a foretaste of what I will eventually do on a big scale. You can have glimmers of redemptive possibilities even amidst exile. If you want me to speak later rabbinic Hebrew, you can have Shabbos in New York. New York is a bad example because Jews are hyper comfortable. You can have Shabbos in... No, I don't even want to say that. I want to imagine like in medieval Spain. Late medieval Spain, okay? We'll say that. In late medieval... You can have Shabbos, meaning you can have glimmers. That's not Jeremiah talking. That's a more kind of rabbinic understanding of what Shabbat is, right? You can have a foretaste of what will eventually happen right now. You can build and can plant here. The more you take this advice, the harder it will be to go home when it's time. That's just the way it is. And so Jeremiah is taking a great theological risk here. Now, I want to just mention something else that I don't feel qualified to talk about. I know, I think Lowenfeld's like, yeah, I've never stopped you before. But no, I don't feel qualified to talk about this, but I'm going to say it anyway. There is like a school of Bible scholarship that wants to read this text as a paradigm of nonviolent ethos towards one's enemies. What are you supposed to do to Babylon? I don't know. Be freedom fighters, terrorists, make their life miserable. No. Pray for their peace and participate in the flourishing of that city. That's what you do. Whether that's an overreading, I don't know. According to Deuteronomy 20, those who have recently built a new house or planted a vineyard are exempted from military service. When you tell people, plant a vineyard and build a house, I wonder whether one of the things you're telling them is, military resistance is not what we're into here. Do not become terrorists. Do not become freedom fighters. Do not become whatever term we're going to use. I'm not equating those things, right? Let the contemporary Jewish lunatics all calm down. When you're telling people to do that very thing that is the thing that exempts you from military service, I kind of wonder whether in a coded way you're saying resistance of that kind is just not, that's not our project here. Accept your exile in Babylon. That's one of the main claims that Jeremiah wants to make. Do not resist it. You may hope for the future, but first you must accept the present.
So my question is, where is the warning about assimilation? He's saying you should take wives and you get sons and daughters, take wives for sons and give your daughters back. You know, they're not necessarily going to stay within the fold.
You know, it's interesting. So I was reading last week a Bible scholar's essay on Jeremiah in which he says something that would not be how I would have read these verses, and I don't think it's how many Bible scholars read these verses, which is that Jeremiah is saying, build enclaves in which you pray for the well-being of those beyond your enclave. I guess you could read it that way, but I don't see anything in the words to suggest that. I don't think he thinks at this moment that that's the danger. Now, whether that's naive, meaning I think he might say, your question is spoken like a good 21st century American Jew, right? I mean, most times in Jewish history, you weren't exactly welcomed with open arms. Assimilation wasn't exactly an option. You know, this is a terribly offensive thing, but it was really interesting. The late Leonard Fine used to say in the 1990s, for thousands of years they wanted to kill us and they decided they wanted to marry us. And it's very disorienting. It's very disorienting, right? Jews are nothing if not confused by this experience in all kinds of ways. So I don't know that Jeremiah had the thought that they could assimilate. I'm not sure. I would not be so sure that he thought, oh, you know, you'll marry a Babylonian. I don't know. I don't know that Babylonian wants to marry Chaim Schwartz. Not sure.
Wondering whether you see this reference to these to multiply and this sort of generational resonance of almost a blessing to Abraham.
Yeah.
Built into this language that, you know, actually this is exactly what God's promise was to the people is to build themselves a whole group of descendants.
So I think that's a really great comment because I think that the link here is also to the first chapter of Exodus, where we hear that even amidst affliction in Egypt, Uvene Israel Paru by Yishritzu, which is also the narrator's way of saying that even in a time where God seems absent, the divine blessings are still at play in some way. In some ways, Jeremiah is saying, recapitulate the experience of your ancestors in Egypt. You're not going to be slaves, which in some ways obviously is much better, but in terms of your question is worse. No one wants to marry their slaves, but they do want to marry their banker. Really? No, I think that's really important. I'm not trying to be flip here at all. And so you think your comment is right on. In other words, it's sort of like at minimum God is saying, maintain the blessings that I have given you. If you look at Psalm 139, the Al Naharot Bavel, sorry, did I keep saying 139? It's 137. They say, Eich nashir et shir Adonai al admat nechar. How can we sing the song of our God on foreign soil? In other words, according to that psalm, it was hard enough for the exiles to imagine that they could pray to God in Babylon. Jeremiah is asking them not only to do that, but to pray to God for Babylon. And when you juxtapose Psalm 137 with Jeremiah 29, you realize just how hard this is. Most people in this room, I don't know about all, most people in this room have never been in that situation where you're being asked to pray for someone who has directly caused your world to fall apart. It's a lot. You see now why Christian scholars are tempted to say this is an adumbration of Christ's mandate to love your enemies. Again, that's not a crazy reading of what Jeremiah is saying. Of course, the more you want to read this, going back to Eli's comment earlier, as fundamentally about practicality in politics, the less you're going to want to read it that way. Right? If this is about practicality in politics, not about praying for your enemies, it's about looking out for your survival. But the more you think that there's some kind of value proposition here, the more you're going to say, oh, yeah, pray for your enemies. One of the things that I write about at great length in my, I can now finally say, forthcoming book, is the whole question of, is there a mitzvah to love your enemies in Jewish thought? To which the answer is, it is extremely complicated. It is not as simple as the no that you're often imagined that the answer is. And it is more complicated than a simple yes. But you certainly do have moments where seeking the well-being of your enemies is actually really important. I mean, I don't know whether this is a direct commentary on the New Testament, and I actually don't think I write about this in the book, but the scene, the famous scene in the Talmud with Hillel and his, with Rabbi Meir and his wife, where Rabbi Meir prays for people who are bothering him to die, and his wife says, "What's wrong with you? We don't do that. Why don't you pray for them to change instead of die?" That's pray for those who persecute you. I mean, it's exactly that idea. One of the things that I will go to my grave saying is that Jewish understanding of Judaism has been almost unimaginably distorted and destroyed by this American preoccupation that emerged at a certain point between imagining that whatever Christianity is, Judaism is the opposite. Based on an impoverished understanding of Christianity and then an unimaginably impoverished understanding of Judaism, right? How many people have ever been taught by their rabbi, Judaism has no notion of the afterlife, right? This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. Like, it's factually just stupid, right? And yet it comes from an American Jewish narrative in which Christianity is only about the afterlife, right? They don't care about living. They just care about getting into the heaven, right? So we must be. We don't have a notion of heaven, right? Which is, the only problem is you're totally wrong about Christianity and Judaism. Otherwise, it's very helpful, right? It's not, I mean, it's ridiculous. So I think the question of loving your enemies is really complicated. It is certainly not the case that in Jewish texts there is a mandate to love your enemies in the way that there is in Christian ones. That is certainly the case. That is, you know, when it comes to an issue like that, the issue is not all or nothing. And by the way, what Jesus meant by it is also endlessly controversial among New Testament scholars. Okay. I want to say there's something actually quite important here also, and this is just one step further for a minute in verse 7. It is very common for Christians, and I think it is very common for liberal Jews as well, to hear Jewish texts whenever possible as having a sense of Jewish mission to the broader world. In liberal Jews here, I include people like Samson Raphael Hirsch, right, for whom, like, you know, Jews lived in Germany so that they could educate the non-Jews in monotheism. I mean, one of the things that a friend of mine who's a Jewish historian likes to say is one of the poignant and ironic and sad statements about Jewish thought in the 19th century is that all these rabbis are talking about how Jews are in exile to educate the non-Jews, and none of the non-Jews notice. But they don't, like, you're here to do what? Really? Really? Okay, great. You know, we're so glad you're here. Right? It's very strange. The interesting thing is the Christian claim, for example, that a text like this is quote-unquote missional. That doesn't mean convert people, but it means you have some kind of responsibility for the broader community. I will say that I have major reservations about almost all missional readings of the Old Testament, quote unquote, because in part, basically the history of Christian Bible scholarship goes something like this. The Hebrew Bible was all about the mission of the Jews, which they failed, and therefore God chose to replace them with someone else. It is very rare in traditional Christian Bible commentary that you have an allusion to Jewish mission that does not come with a follow-up statement that is, and you guys are total failures. And I'm just not sure that a lot of biblical texts that seem to be about mission in light of the history of the West that we live in are actually about mission at all. Va'atem tiyuli mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. You should be for me a kingdom of priests. One after another, Protestant Bible scholars say, that is, what do priests do? They mediate God's blessing to others. So the Jews are being told, right, you have to mediate for me, my relationship with the rest of the world. I'm really not so sure. I wonder if that verse means priests have a uniquely intimate access to me, and so do you. Now, like liberal universalist Jews don't like that, which I understand, but I also think be careful what interpretations of the Bible you get into bed with. One of the tragedies of American Jewish culture, it seems to me, is American Jews have totally internalized the Christian claim that universalism is always superior to particularism. And the problem with that is that the history of universalism is literally inextricable from the history of imperialism. Universalists hurt people. Particularists leave people alone. Now, I'm not saying there's not a downside to particularism. It just can be bigoted and horrible and all of that. But like Christian love has littered human history with corpses. It's complicated. So just be careful when you accept this sort of totally Christian idea that, oh, you know, the moments of great progress in the Hebrew Bible are universalism. Second Isaiah, Kabbalat Shabbat, universalist Psalms. You know, I don't know. The way that I've said this in writing, for whatever it's worth, is that Jews have always excelled at leaving people alone. And their downside has been that they've often forgotten that other people matter. Christians have never forgotten that other people matter. And it took them 2,000 years to even consider leaving anyone alone. I don't know which one of those things is better. I'm not making an anti-Christian polemic, quite the contrary. I actually think it's just worth understanding what's at stake in that really difficult choice. And I just, with American Jews, did not completely internalize the dominant Christian narrative. So that what we have to do when we talk about Judaism is say, we're universalists too. We have that. We also have other things. And those other things are not something to be embarrassed about. So I already mentioned that the issue here is a combination of is it just prayer or is it work and prayer? Okay? Now, what you then have in verses 8 and 9 is they are told, do not listen to false prophets who tell you to go that you will go home soon. Ki cho amar Adonai tzvaot Elohei Yisrael, al yasiu lachem nevi'echem, asher bekirbechem bekosmechem, ve'al tishmu et chalomotechem asher atem mechalmim. This is what the God of hosts, the God of Israel, said. Do not let the prophets and diviners in your midst trick you. Pay no heed to the dreams that they dream. I know it says atem, but I'm going with hem for the moment. Ki vasheker hem nibaim lachem bishmi, lo shelachtim ne'um Adonai. For they prophesy to you in my name falsely. I didn't send them, says God. But rather, verse 10, you want to take over? For thus said God, when 70 years are over, I will remember you. I will take note of you, and I will fulfill with you my promise of goodness to bring you back to this place. Because I know what I am thinking, what I am planning for you, says God. Thoughts of peace rather than evil, to give you a future and a hope. And you will call me and go and pray to me, and I will hear you. Meaning, remember, this is not over. When I say to you, make peace with being in Babylon, I do not mean forever. I will be back. This doesn't even really appear to be conditional on their repentance. To use another word that Jews have largely, tragically abandoned, this is a kind of promise of divine grace. I love you. What am I going to do? I love you. At some point, I'm going to take you back. Hear the Deuteronomy sound. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all of your heart. B'chol levavchem, Deuteronomy language, right? Sorry, one more verse. V'nim tzeti lachem. Okay, I sent you there and I will bring you home. Okay? In other words, the message of this chapter, which I've now said too many times, is settle into the land, but know that that settling is not final and is not forever. And really interestingly, language that is used often for punishment, pakad, is here used for hope, right? For restoration. Similarly, by the way, the word acharit sometimes means, right, a bad end. But here, the acharit is a renewal at the end. In other words, and this is just like for understanding the historical context here, the difference between Jeremiah and what he calls the false prophets is not over whether God will eventually break Babylon and allow the Judeans to go home. It's a question of when and what has to happen before that takes place. Right? In other words, there is no shalom in the fantasy of a quick overthrow of Babylon. That is not a path. And I think there's something really interesting here about, and something worth thinking about even in our own time. Hope does not come at the expense of realism. Hope is not purchased by saying, I'm denying the reality of what is happening to me. Like, we are not going to wake up tomorrow and find an America that some of us might miss. This is not, that's not how it's going to be. And yet, someone like Jeremiah might say, don't lose hope. And somehow, hope does not step around the reality of the present. The number 70 here is interesting. It's unclear where that number comes from. It could be someone writing after the fact, knowing how long the exile in fact was, or probably more likely, it could be a conventional number for a period of divine judgment, to use that way in other ancient Near Eastern sources. Like 70 is just like a period. Psalm 90 tells us that 70 years is a human lifespan. I don't know what, I mean, in the ancient world, that's a good, robust lifespan. Whether that's relevant here as part of the meaning of that number, I'm honestly not sure. What you would see in verse 11 that we just read is interesting, and I just want you to see it. God says, my plan is to give you shalom. In verse 7, shalom was a task. In verse 11, shalom is a promise. There, in verse 7, it was the shalom of Babylon that was spoken of. Here, in verse 11, it's the shalom of the Judean community. One of the things that I think is really striking about a text like this, hope here and promise do not preclude the reality of judgment. They come after judgment, not instead of it. That's just the reality of the biblical picture of how God works with Israel. Whether and how you want to translate that into your own 21st century idiom is a different discussion I'd be happy to have with people. But in other words, I think to understand the Bible's own assumptions is, like, one of the things that I often struggle with when I'm teaching biblical theological texts, and people will say, I don't understand how you can say that the God of the Bible is merciful, God punishes them. To which I think the biblical writers would sort of scratch their head and be like, I don't really understand that question. Yeah, yeah, there are consequences, and then there's mercy. The mercy is the consequences are not as bad as they might be, the consequences are not permanent, right? There is judgment and mercy. After all, that's a fundamental Jewish claim, right? There's judgment and mercy. Walter Brueggemann, contemporary Bible scholar, has the following wonderful sentence about Jeremiah 29. This text is against both illusionary expectation and despairing resignation. It speaks of God's powerful governance, which both settles into exile and ends it. In my closing shiur at the end of the executive seminar, we're going to look at what happens when the prophecies of it's about to happen emerge. You have this emergence in various places of the discourse of this is going to be so good, it's going to make the exodus of old look like nothing. And then you see the explosion of hope that comes after this period of living in exile. Okay, thank you very much.